So as Nisken Prabhu mentioned, we had a very beautiful beginning to our series of Sunday talk shows last week. Last week, we were very much talking about science, politics, contemporary issues, the situation of the world that we're living in today. It was very much a debate. Today, we're kind of shifting gears, and we are very much looking towards another world, another reality, going beyond our immediate situation, and really entering spiritual space. Today we're going to be discussing topics of Vrindavan, the land of Lord Krishna. We know in our tradition that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed his followers, the Goswamis, in many, many different ways. And one of his instructions to the Goswamis of Vrindavan was Lupta Tirtha Udhar, that excavate the holy places and make the holy places known to the entire world for generations to come. These tirthas are very, very special. The etymological meaning of the word tirtha means to cross over. A tirtha is literally a bridge, an entrance to eternity, a gateway to an eternal reality, and an opportunity to connect with the spiritual world. And of all tirthas, it's explained that the source of all dhams, just as Krishna is the source of all incarnations, Vrindavan is the source of all holy places, the original abode. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching, as outlined by our acharyas, Aradhyo Bhagavan Vrajay Shatanayas Tadhama Vrindavanam, that for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, Krishna is the ultimate object of worship, and specifically Krishna who resides in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So Vrindavan is known as, we know there's Vrindavan of the eternal reality known as Goloka Vrindavan. And many of us are also familiar that Vrindavan also manifests in this world as Bhoma Vrindavan or the earthly Vrindavan. So here on the slides you can see a very beautiful map of Sri Vrindavan Dham, 164 miles in circumference. Many of you may well have been on Vrindavan Parikrama and visited all of these places, especially during the month of Kartik. So we know there is the transcendent Vrindavan, and we also know that there is the earthly Vrindavan in this world that each one of us can and each one of us may have also traveled to. But what is also revealed by our acharyas is that Vrindavan can also manifest in another way. By the devotion, by the inspiration, by the vision of the Krishna Bhakta, the devotees of Krishna, Vrindavan can also manifest in other places. Here we have a drawing of what was previously a piece of land in Hungary. And by the vision and inspiration of the devotees of Krishna, this piece of land has now been transformed into what we call an envisioned dham, non-different from the Vrindavan that we can travel to. And so we'd like to begin this evening by asking Maharaj, this is the piece of land that you see, and this is the Vrindavan that has been envisioned and created by all the Vaishnavas of the Hungarian Yatra, led by His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj. So Maharaj, we'd like to begin by asking you, how does that process take place by which a seemingly ordinary piece of land in Hungary then becomes a holy place which is non-different from Vrindavan?
The existence of the Dham itself is not a geographical place. So often we tend to think that, I don't know, spiritual world is up there and not so spiritual world is down there, but even from the study of the fifth canto cosmology, we get an idea that the universe is not just a three-dimensional thing, and many of the accesses that are available are based on consciousness. There's one lecture where Srila Prabhupada talks about places in the world where you can access higher domains. Sounds almost like a Bermuda Triangle. And similarly, Goloka Vrindavan Dham is not up there. It is everywhere. Just like Krishna is everywhere, Krishna is all-pervasive, so that means that his Dham is also all-pervasive, and it's everywhere. And that Dham, just like Krishna, how is the all-pervasive Krishna accessed? Well, especially in this day and age, Bhakti Yoga is the general process, and the most specific means of bhakti is through Nam Sankirtan. So when one chants without offense, when one chants with love, then Krishna manifests. Whether you happen to be in desert in Saudi Arabia or wherever it isn't that Krishna went there from somewhere else, he's already there. He's everywhere. Similarly, wherever Krishna is, Tadham Vrindavanam, as they're saying. So, Krishna Svadharma Pagati. When Krishna leaves this world, the Dham also leaves with him. When he comes, the Dham also appears. But even when he's gone, when, you know, it isn't that the whole universe fell apart because Krishna went and all the atoms all of a sudden disintegrated because there was nothing to keep them together. Krishna is everything and he is everywhere. And similarly, his associates as well as his Dham. So the question when we go to Hungary and we're in a quite a remote place. It's at the end of the road. And actually, it's beyond the end of the road. The end of the road stopped, and then we just kept going. That's where the farm starts. Devotees, wanted to establish Srila Prabhupada's vision for a self-sufficient community that is also a spiritual retreat, a place of pilgrimage, as Srila Prabhupada would write in his seven articles. So the real founder of New Brajadam, just like the founder of New Vrindavan and the founder of everything in ISKCON, is Srila Prabhupada. Whether that happened in Srila Prabhupada's manifest presence or Prabhupada's absence, Srila Prabhupada wanted it. So based on Srila Prabhupada's desire that these things happen, when devotees' desires connect with Srila Prabhupada's desire, then Krishna becomes very attentive. And similarly, the Dham also becomes attentive. So Krishna in the form of Radha Shyama Sundar, and then his Dham, Prabhupada also writes that wherever the deity is, then Vrindavan is there. And of course, wherever Krishna and Vrindavan are, Krishna manifests all of his pastimes as well. So really it's a matter of consciousness. I guess I should keep it short, but the Boma Vrindavan, which is Vrindavan in India, that's the Vrindavan that we all go to, it's called Boma Vrindavan. That Boma Vrindavan is specifically and directly sustained and maintained by Krishna. So it is, all of these dhams are maintained by a certain potency, by a certain energy. So even when the locals neglect to take care of their temples and the streets and the holy places and to keep the sacred Jamuna clean. But nonetheless, the dam stays there by Krishna's desire. Similarly, holy places, here we have the same thing here. So this is New Gokula. And therefore we have Gokulananda here. And the same thing that goes on in New Rajadham also goes on here. And the same dam is also present here. How conscious or not conscious we are of it is another thing. But specifically the maintenance or maintaining that dam will partly depend on the deity's will and also the devotees who are really sort of dedicated to that end. Does that answer your question?
So, Maharaj, there are hundreds of ISKCON temples around the world. Can everyone hear? So there are hundreds of ISKCON temples around the world. Are each of those equal in terms of their dham status? Or is it something which differentiates the degree to which the dham manifests in a particular place?
Nothing competes with Bhoma Vrindavan. That it has a unique status. My understanding is that Bhoma Vrindavan, as Srila Prabhupada described it, it is like the embassy. And the embassy of Goloka Vrindavan. And other places are like consulates, which is almost identical, but at the same time, some of their functions may vary. Consulates can easily be withdrawn, just like, now in Afghanistan, and I'm just trying to remember somewhere else, where they just immediately in the smaller cities withdrew the consulates. But embassies are generally a much more solid statement that, yes, our country's interest is here. So Krishna's interest in being here and making himself known is there. So, and in terms of the individual places, it will depend on how the manifestation of those places, or how much they manifest the identity of a dham and the energy of a dham, will depend upon the devotees. It's just like chanting Hare Krishna. Is everybody chanting Hare Krishna equal? Well, the mantra is the same, but depending on the consciousness and how devotees chant, the mantra reciprocates proportionally. Similarly with the deities. So, Lord Kapila Dev says deities want to talk to devotees, and the devotees want to talk to the deities. So some devotees may hear the deities, if the very advanced devotees, but others not. The deity is the same. And yet, according to the Jejitamam Prapadyante, according to the devotion of the devotee, then they will perceive it differently, or even a different level of potency will be manifest. Krishna reciprocates, the dham will reciprocate. If devotees are oblivious, then they may have difficulty perceiving it. If they're under very difficult conditions, for instance, I was just in Soho Street. So Radhalandanishwara or Krishna. So, but you're in Soho Street, you're in downtown London, in that extraordinary environment. So you've really got to be Krishna conscious to actually conceive of the idea that, yes, I'm actually in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world. Srila Prabhupada wrote to Sarva Mangala Devadasi here at the manor that wherever our temples are, these are actually Vaikuntha. So Vaikuntha in the general sense. So the temples themselves already generate that atmosphere. How much we reciprocate with that, that means how much will they manifest a certain degree of spiritual potency.
So consciousness, Nam Sankirtan, deity worship. Would you say those are the key ingredients which elicit the manifestation of the Dhamma?
Many things. Srila Prabhupada gave us his books. So Krishna's pastimes, the truths of Krishna, understanding actually Krishna, Jyomambaiti, Tattvataha, to understand Krishna in truth. These things are really integral to having the right perception, consciousness, and appreciation that something is actually beyond my perception, and yet I have the faith, because everything will start with the faith. I have the faith of that it is here and how it's here. So whatever requirement makes up Krishna consciousness, those ingredients are needed. Like with everything. In other words, it's appreciating things as they are, and we do it in so many different ways with so many different things. This is just another. It's how do you appreciate the presence of Srila Prabhupada in his murti? How do you appreciate the presence of Srila Prabhupada or the spiritual master in his vani? So according to how you value that, to that degree you become empowered by it. If you don't value it, then it's just words. But if you really, really appreciate it, then it becomes something that empowers you, enables you to mukam karoti vachalam pangum langa iti girim.
So Maharaj, you've explained how the essence of a dham is that Krishna is the center. Of course, we hear this in Shastra. Yatra gayanti mad bhakta tatra tisthami narada, wherever the devotees are chanting and engaged in absorbed Krishna consciousness, Krishna appears there. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also explains in one of his songs, Jai Dina Grihe Bhajana Deki, that his home, he saw Goloka manifested in his own home. But Maharaj, I wanted to ask you specifically about...
It was just on what basis? Just his consciousness. So if you're Bhaktivinoda Thakur consciousness, then your home becomes the temple. Your home becomes the spiritual world. Excuse me.
What we see in New Vraja Dham is something, I would say, which is very unique, maybe extra special, that what you've done is not just created a community in which the chanting of Krishna's names is done in a very absorbed and powerful way, but what you've actually done is recreated almost the geography of Vrindavan. So we can see here on the slide that Vrindavan has many, many landmarks and beautiful places where Krishna performed different pastimes. And you've established those same places in New Vraja Dham. Just like we have a parikrama, you have a parikrama of New Vraja Dham that the devotees go on. So can you tell us a little bit about how you actually took the geography of Bhoma Vrindavan and mapped that into the geography of New Vraja Dham, and how you actually established all these places in the way we see it in front of us here?
The original impetus or inspiration was the temple president at that time asked me to write sort of a spiritual constitution, not how the yatra or the temple will work, the New Vraja Dham will work, but what's its spiritual foundations and something sort of brief. And so first I began by actually researching on the Dham. I really regret that at that time Sandarbhas weren't really made available in English. So Bhagavat Sandarbha, Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami speaks there about Dham, and I don't know Sanskrit. But other than that, information about Dham Tattva was not easy to come by. In fact, there's no, I don't find any chapter anywhere in any book, Dham Tattva. Prabhupada, of course, was the first port of call, and after that, I went through other Shastra, Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Charitamrita, and then Puranas, and I've got a big, big library of thousands of books. So I really selected the ones that I could. And I started off with about 150 pages of notes of just what, that's what I usually do. I just collect excerpts, then I correlate them according to subject, and I abbreviate them so I get a really flow of what they're saying, and then on the basis of that, then I have information. So I need to have a little structured information. And then I became a little clearer as to what it means that a place becomes the Dham, how that Dham becomes manifest, and what the Boma Vrindavan is, what are other Gupta Dhams that exist around the world. I found one book that was really quite helpful, a PhD thesis
Vishnupur,
not called Vishnupur, it's called, yeah, anyway, the place in which Srinivas Acharya converted, Birhambir, and Vishnupur. I forget a lot of things. That was extremely helpful. That was like a prototype for what I was writing, because under Srinivas Acharya's supervision, Birhambir made a replica, a duplicate of Vrindavan in his kingdom. It was very nice. He brought all kinds of trees and everything. He constructed a Jamuna. He had holy places. He had different temples that he installed. He had very good standards in his kingdom. Everyone had to chant 64 rounds. Otherwise, they were given their walking papers. That was like everybody had spies going around, and people had to chant 64 rounds a day. And of course, they had to be followers of Srinivas Acharya. So that was very helpful. And then at that point, I had, if we're going to establish where are the holy places in New Brajadam. We had certain fixed geographical references. One was our water source, which is the Jamuna that comes out, or at least it came out this summer. They dried up for the first time ever in 30 years. But we had 14 springs that come up on one end, and they form a creek, which we had dammed up, and have two lakes, two water bodies. And that we'd always known as the Jamuna, and that was fixed. And we also had constructed our barn by that time, and that was fixed. So obviously the barn is underground, the Jamuna is here flowing on the left-hand side. More or less it divides the farm in two. And that was opposite to Boma Vrindavan. So here in New Brajadam, north-south correlates to south-north and east-west to west-east. If you think that's complicated, it's really complicated. It's sort of like mirror reflection. And based on that and obvious geographical features, I spent 2 months correlating Boma Vrindavan to New Brajadam. I had quite a few Parikram books. I had Parikram books from different Vaishnav groups who do parikrama around Vrindavan, about the places. Obviously, there's countless. So I couldn't select all of them. But I did select 600. And that's a lot. So in the book, you have pastimes that correlate to about 600 places, pastime places. And of the major ones, we then celebrated by building these pavilions, or at least having these pavilions made. The same people who made our elephants in the that are sort of at the reception. If any devotees have seen, we have these big life-size elephants, and they were. I'd offered at the time to get some made for the manor. I thought they would be look very nice over here, but anyway. We have 14 pavilions, Nandagram, Barkhana, and Govardhan, two on Govardhan. So these holy places are specifically marked out, mapped out. And then I worked out a inner parikrama, an outer parikrama, as is sort of customary, on which people walk. Yes, thank you. Those are very good. And I spent some time walking out there. Since I'm going to write about it, I may as well go check it all out. So it was easy here. And this was before the time of drones also, unfortunately. That would have made life very easy, or comparatively easy. It is, in certain places it's brush, in certain places it's muddy. But it was a lot of... It was a lot of fun. It was very educational. And we have a sort of a rough correlation. For me, the my understanding was that physical correlation was not so important. It was more the faith, the meditation, the absorption of devotees in particular places that really counts. And it sort of sunk in. So if devotees didn't take advantage of these places, then it's just, that's all you got. You got a map. And you're buying a map book. But devotees do. We have devotees from Hungary. They come. They do parikrama. Even in our college, part of the college course is studying holy places. And so devotees come for almost a week, and they do that. Students, the residents, they go to different places and read about the pastimes, and they sort of relax over there and chant their rounds. When we had in June on Pandav Nirjal Ekadasi, then our GBC went chanting 192 rounds with devotees. It's a good GBC who chants 192 rounds. And went to different places with a group of devotees chanting. So that actually really gives a really stamp of acceptance by devotees. It manifests the presence of Krishna's pastimes in the Dhamma there. There's a lot that I could say, but I don't want to talk forever about that. It's a big book. It was supposed to be 100 pages.
And maybe that's a good time to go onto the book, Maharaj. This is a picture of you surrounded by all your different source books. As we know, Krishna's pastimes are outlined primarily, as we know, in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, but then we know there are many other Puranic references and many, many commentaries of the Acharyas which bring greater detail to all of Krishna's pastimes. And Navaraja Mahima, your 9-volume set, is really a parikrama around Nuvraja Dham, recounting all the pastimes of Krishna at the different places of pilgrimage. Could you say something about how that book came together, how you managed to look at so many different sources, how you decided to pick what would come together and weave it together, and how what was initially meant to be, I think you say in your introduction, a small booklet, ended up into 5,000 pages of writing.
Six.
Okay.
It was, I'd written a few books up till then. Usually they were always on schedule and according to plan. In other words, I planned this would be about this big on the basis of the topic and the amount of research I'd already done on it. Never Rajma was a different book. It sort of went at its own pace. I went on parikrama. I couldn't write out there. Sometimes I would actually go out to places, but generally I had to be by the computer, by the reference books. But I would walk the parikrama according to going actually on parikrama of Vrindavan. So that was Brajmandal parikrama. And I went through multiple places and I wrote about the places. Anyone who, if you read these parikram books, the pastimes are, you know, they say this is where Krishna and the cowherd boys lay down and took rest under the tree. So that's how do you elaborate on that? As Kaviraj Goswami says, how do you fluff it out in the same way that you sort of fluff out a little piece of cotton and make it into a big ball? And that's really what took place as I went from place to place, and the fluffing out became fluffier and fluffier, and it got bigger and bigger. I realized it was it sort of had a life of its own, and I was just going along for the ride. So something was manifesting. Even later on, devotees asked me about the book. I mean, I forget. I'm multiple books down from this one, and I don't remember very much when we start talking, then things come. But the referencing went along that basis in terms of pastime. And then I always considered putting in relevant tattva and philosophy as the occasion required. And it often did to actually highlight either certain features relating to Krishna. Later on, when I finished, and I finished in the sixth volume, and then we had this map book, which is really a map book, as a seventh volume. But then I thought that this would really be complete if it's relevant to the both Gayatri mantras that the devotees chant, as well as the holy name. It's a lot of work, and I wrote for, I can't remember how long did I write for.
6 years.
Huh?
6 years.
6 years, and I was writing 8, 10, 12 hours a day. So it was a wonderful absorption. It was a real meditation for me. That was one Vaishnava who knew and sometimes would live with Srila Prabhupada at Radha Damodara Temple. He sort of commented that when it was asked, well, you know, did Srila Prabhupada do bhajan and so on, as we usually envisage devotees in Vrindavan doing bhajan? And he said, well, it seemed like his bhajan was writing. That was Srila Prabhupada's bhajan, commenting on Srimad Bhagavatam. So that it became a real bhajan. And
Maharaj, I have to ask you on that. You're a guru, you're a GBC, you're probably...
I'm not a GBC anymore.
Oh, you're a GBC.
So
someone else's is producing.
You're probably a port of call for all kinds of managerial issues and chaos. And how in the midst of all of that are you able to simultaneously switch off and enter into that kind of absorption which is required to produce something like this? Can you give us some idea of how we can?
I had great assistance from devotees, and for the most part, I handed over all really duties and responsibilities. I mean, like continuing on functioning as a GBC and going to GBC meetings, but my traveling was really very minimal, and management and other things was more or less done by the local devotees. They were very helpful. They were really squirming at times, and then I had to obviously come back in. But for the most part, it was a real cooperative effort. Had they not really shouldered at least the local issues, I wouldn't have been able to focus. But somehow my nature also is that I have a real compartmentalized brain, and I can click out of one part and click into the other part. Unless things become too overwhelming and too destructive, there are such things in life and in ISKCON. So it was really with the help of devotees that I could actually do that. It was not without its costs. I mean, it did have some fallout.
I'm sure Shambhari Prabhu has many memories, but I remember serving you, Maharaj, in Juhu during some midterm GBC meetings.
Really?
Yeah, and you were you were leaving around just before 10 for the meetings, a whole day of meetings. I'm sure there were many intense topics and so on. You'd return at around 7. Have a little bowl of puff rice. I'll bring you a bit of puff rice. And then you brought a huge trunk of books with you to those meetings. And I'd watch you. There was a window. You probably didn't. I never told you this. But there was a window opposite your room. And I would watch you. And you would be writing with a little lamp and all of your books surrounded with those books until 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. And I remember that schedule. You did that throughout those meetings. It was...
I can't remember.
It was...
Sounds good.
It was... I observed it, Maharaj, and it was amazing to see that kind of intensity and absorption alongside so many other responsibilities.
It's the nature of the subject. It's the nature of the subject. So, you know, if you're in a meeting and you come home and you see 10 bars of gold on your table, it's not hard to focus, at least not if you're a Vaishya. Although probably everyone would be able to focus. So it's like that. It's just so engrossing that actually coming out is what becomes the painful thing. And sometimes, obviously, both things are there, and it's the same service to Krishna that we have to do, but there's a difference in the experience.
I think, Maharaj, we'd all like to kind of go a little bit into Navavraja Mahima and maybe have a little bit of a reading. So we've picked a section on the divine forest of Kamyavan, and we thought to give everyone a little bit of a taste of what Navavraja Mahima is like. Before we begin, Maharaj, this is the basic structure that you've used for the writing, these almost three-line prose stanzas. Can you just say something about why you used that structure? It seems like something very unique.
Well, first, I thought to do this in poetry and tried But then I also timed it. And I realized how much longer it's going to take to do this in poetry. I can't remember the actual reasoning, but I wanted to maintain somehow that type of stanza or the poetry couplet type mood. And rather than just having a regular format, paragraph format. And had we done it with poetry, it still probably may not be finished. I'd still be writing it. To make it actually really nice, and I don't know, iambic pentameter or something like that, A-B, and make it make sense, make it nice, have a proper meter, it would be a lot of work. And what to speak of for the editor would be even more work to edit this. It's one thing to write it, and then someone's going to correct all the mistakes and keep all of those things. So this was sort of an alternative. It's a little different, it's a little poetic, and it's also gives a little more of a light feeling, especially when you have so many volumes in your hand, then it's easier to read. It makes the reading easy. I'll just go a little further. It's something that I've developed in the current book I'm using very much, to use layout as a form of communication and as a form of facilitating the message. Usually writers, publishers want to conserve space because, you know, the bigger the book, the more it costs. And there are ways of facilitating expression, just like, you know, if you paint a picture with someone's facial expression, then that gets a particular message across. Fear, happiness, laughter, and so on. So you can do a similar thing just with how things are laid out and how you break up either conversations or even paragraphs. And now I'm writing the current one. There's a producer's nightmare. I'm trying to do it actually a month. Of course, this is actually, this whole book is five color. But we're doing the same thing, but multiple different colors. For quotations and text is one color, quotation is another. And then running head, which is what you got here on the top, another color. Make it easier on the reader. And we did that with this latest book because, well, I can read this, but some other things I can't read anymore. So made it with really big letters. That's why it's so big, actually. And that added 100 plus pages onto the book just to make it such a big font. But then it becomes reader friendly, especially for people who don't read very much nowadays. People seem to read less and less.
Okay, so we'll
let's read a little.
Have a little bit of a reading, yes. So I'll begin reading. Is it possible to get the slide up here so everyone can follow along? And Marge will.
Can we turn this off? It's really, this is just flashing on and off for us. What's up? Either just keep it on or turn it off.
So we're reading about the forest of Kamyavan. The word karma means desire, and because the fulfillment of every kind of desire is perfected in this forest of many charming Kamya groves and lakes, it has always been known as Kamyavan. Kamyavan forest fulfills not only the material desires of its visitors and the spiritual desires of Vaishnavas, but also Krishna's and the gopis' hankerings for pure, amorous, loving exchanges, known also as karma. Also called Kamavan, Kamyaka, Kamyakavan, this fourth forest of Raj qualifies visitors to relish the Lord's abode by freeing them of sinful reactions and blessing them with pure devotion.
Who's been to Nandagram? Who's been to Kamyavan? Yeah, few devotees, few hands. When you come to Nandagram, then you've been to Pavana Sarovar. So the road that's between Pavana Sarovar and Nandagram, you keep going, then you come to Kamyavan. And right beyond Kamyavan, you're in Rajasthan. You cross the state line. And this word kama is something that Kamyavan then becomes, or Kaman, is the capital of Kamyavan. It's a very, very wonderful place. Just recently, myself, Govinda Maharaj, we were on Parikram, and then we went over there because Indradyumna Maharaj and his old Parikram party was there. If you're going on that road, just to the left, against Nandagram Hill, Nandishwar Hill, there's a wonderful place of Krishna's footprints. There are multiple places in Vrindavan where Krishna's footprints are embedded in stone. These are really good footprints. And the people who are there, the Saivites, are very, very nice. They're very friendly. Krishna's footprints, cow's footprints, you can do whatever is respectfully you want to do. It's a very, very nice thing. I just want to comment this word kama. And Srila Prabhupada generally translates it as lust. It has really a lot of meanings. It also means here, as is stated here, desire. What we perceive here in the material world as love, affection, etc., are different aspects of the original kama, isha krodha, isha rajaguna, sumud bhava, of the original kama that's the cause of our being in the material world. You call it whatever you want, but that's what it is. And when we're talking, we use the same word, the same terminology, which often may put us off as to what actually this really is about. When we're talking about calm in the spiritual sense and those things that relate to Krishna's pastimes, we're talking about the really highest expression of loving devotion, and particularly in the mood of the conjugal mellow, Krishna's relationship with the gopis. But it is, as Srila Prabhupada goes to extraordinary endeavor to point out that this is not anything ordinary, but this is something very spiritual and transcendental, and it's not something that we should identify with our experience. And maybe we'll come back to this later. And that is what often makes devotees wary about getting into these topics, because they're worried that it is going to inflame their own kama, which is the material kama, or the material reflection of that transcendental thing. And here, Kamyavan is the place that fulfills all desires, a very favorite place of Krishna's pastimes. Mm-hmm.
Kamyavan abounds with sacred places, of which the most prominent lakes, thrones, temples, and pillars, each number 84, although scriptures say that they total in the hundreds and thousands.
The Shastra state that when we talk about holy places in Vrindavan, the number is 60 billion. So every single Tirtha, Dham, holy place, whatever else exists anywhere in the universe, are all in Vrindavan. Now, it's not that they have some representative aspect in Vrindavan. all holy places have their origin in Vrindavan, and it's very important to understand that. So for instance, I don't know if you want to go, and Sridhar Mayapur is the same. It's just they're just a reflection of each other. So if you go to, I don't know, Rishikesh, Haridwar, the Haridwar up the Ganga is just actually the expansion and the extension of the original Haridwar, which is in Vrindavan, which is actually further up by Badrinath. And the Badrinath, here in Vrindavan, it's called Adi Badri, original Badri. This is the original Badrinath in Vrindavan, and its expansion is up in the Himalayas. So every holy place is there, and this is where the holy places originate, because everything comes from Krishna. So everything comes from Krishna's dham. So anything holy comes originally from Krishna and comes from Krishna's abode.
Kaman, the village of Mother Yashoda's parents, lies at the heart of this forest. Nanda Maharaj lived in Kaman on his way to Nandagram, as did the Pandavas for a part of their time in exile. It is said that King Kamasain renovated many of the area's sacred sites, which had almost been lost to the influence of time or to man, as was the case for the lakes that were filled in for agricultural use. Krishna is fond of Kamyavan for its beauty, for the variety of enjoyments it offers, and for the delicacies he and his friends are assured of tasting at the house of his maternal grandparents. As the gopas arrive in Kamyavan, even the cows are excited to see the boys scramble up the trees, pick the ripest and juiciest fruit, loudly taunt one another with jokes, or throw fruit at their friends. The gopas flail their arms and open their eyes wide as they point out to Krishna the odd shapes in certain gardens, groves, or structures which abound in the mysterious forest of Kamyavan. Its lakes are full with every variety of blossoming lotus flower. Its gardens are just as bountiful with flowering vines, and the forest is rich with mysterious desire trees that glow with splendor. The boys wander here and there. Finally, they enter a branch of the Yamuna, form two groups, and enjoy colossal water fights that attract the cows and the forest creatures as spectators. Finally exhausted, the boys put on dry clothes, gather fruit, beg the local people for food, and, along with their lunch packs, enjoy a special picnic in the shade. After resting, they happily head home.
In the book, you'll see many reference points. And I was just looking here, this was 26. This description of Krishna entering Kamyavan is from based on a book called Prayo Bhakti Rasarnava, which is a very interesting book because it's all about Sakyaras. Generally, our acharyas all write almost exclusively about Madhuryaras pastimes, or they write about Krishna's pastimes centered around Madhuryaras. This is exclusively about Cowherd Boy, very wonderful book. I have many, there's a lot of references just for this chapter. I was looking at endnotes, 71 endnotes, to give reference everything. I'm not doing that so much anymore. You know, our whole, the authenticity of Krishna consciousness is, in terms of writing, is somewhat different than what people conceive of as an author's authenticity in the world outside. If you quote somebody else, or you even shadow what they write, and you don't You don't give the reference, that's called plagiarizing. And that's considered to be a very low thing to do, a very unqualified thing to do. It's not right. Now, in Krishna consciousness, our literature is, if you don't plagiarize, you're bogus. In other words, if you think up of something new, there's no new, there's nothing new. Everything has to be what others have said before. And then there's this fluffing out process. Krishna and the cowherd boys went into the forest. Okay, but you can also say, Krishna and the cowherd boys who were dancing and shouting and joy, waving their sticks and playing their flutes and blowing their bugles, went into the forest where the fruits were. So it's the same thing, but it's more descriptive and it gives a picture. And really, ultimately, what is the purpose of these books? It's actually to invoke attachment to Krishna, to Krishna's associates, to Vrindavan, because that becomes the basis of the direction that we take in Krishna consciousness. If you don't hear about Krishna, then it's quite unlikely that we become Krishna conscious. How do you become Krishna conscious without being conscious of Krishna? So Krishna's entrance into Kamyavan, which is close to Nandagram, is something that's very easily conceivable. In this book that I just talked about, this Prayo Bhakti Rasanava, he describes Krishna going to every single forest they head out at around 10 o'clock in the morning and they're out back at 6 in the evening. It is more or less geographically impossible for us to actually replicate that. They're doing parikrama of Vrindavan every single day. And they're doing it with bulls and cows. So, you know, maybe the boys can run fast, but you're not going to get the cows to move fast. So they go at their own pace. And that's, of course, one unique feature that we can see, that this is not an ordinary place. It may look like this is UP, but actually it's not. It's the spiritual world. So they're in a different state of consciousness that allows them to actually move from one place to another at will. And that's something that comes up repeatedly with either our acharyas, great saints, or of course Krishna's pastimes, that Krishna covers sometimes extraordinary distances in a very, very short period of time or fixed period of time. And Kamyavan is one of the favorite places. It's connected to, as it says here, this is Mother Jashoda's birthplace. So his in-laws are here, and you know, when you go to your maternal grandparents, they're always ready to receive you, and they spoil you. So the things that you can't get at home, that your mother won't necessarily give you, although I've never read anything that Mother Jashoda sort of puts Krishna on a diet. It's usually just the opposite. But still, they get a real royal treatment, and when it means they, then there's a lot of them. And of course, how a lot of them become accommodated is another issue. There's this whole concept of, you know, things when they're intimate means that if that happens when there's a fixed number. As soon as the numbers start to become very big, you tend to lose the intimacy, the friendship, the family feeling, the real connection. So in Agasura Lila, when Krishna goes out, then Shukadeva Goswami talks about some billions of cowherd boys going out. And yet at the same time, everyone's seeing Krishna, they're all feeling in a very sort of family atmosphere. This is all happens by the agency of yoga maya. There's a lot of things go on here. I'm just pointing this out. You know, we read 10 stanzas, but the events that take place, you could go on and write 6 volumes just about the 10 stanzas. Because so many inconceivable things come up, and there's extraordinary potencies at work, just which understanding and glorifying are endless.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Kamyavan from Govardhan. The Lord performed parikrama of the forest, bathed in all the lakes, and visited all the pastime places before proceeding to Nandagram. Janava Devi and Veerabhadra Goswami visited Kamyavan on separate occasions. Both followed the path taken by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, enjoying a tour through the sacred lakes and groves. The eminence of Kamyavan as a pilgrimage place and a residence for renunciates has attracted many great personalities to its lakes and groves, all of which perpetually emanate spiritual mellows. In ages long past, the great Durvasa Muni would come here to reflect on the pastimes of Krishna had performed in a previous day of Brahma, as well as those he would perform in the present one. On one such visit, during the Satya Yuga, as Durvasa Muni slept, a boy from heaven mischievously cut a few strands of the sage's matted locks as a memento to show off to his friends. The sage awoke and at once realized that he had been the butt of childish jokes. The Muni cursed the boy, "Since you crawl around to cause mischief, become an alligator for the duration of 4 ages." The boy begged forgiveness, and out of compassion the sage replied, "When the lord of this forest, Krishna, appears in Navadvip as the son of Sachi, he will deliver you by his Naam Sankirtan." The boy then assumed the form of a crocodile and took up residence within a lake in Godrumadvip. He terrorized animals and humans as he waited for his promised deliverance in the far distant future. 4 ages later, as predicted, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in Mayapur. The Lord and his childhood friends once came to play near the lake, where they were warned of the presence of the crocodile. The locals said, "No one bathes or drinks here out of fear of a giant crocodile." At this, Nimai Pandit approached the lake, loudly chanting Krishna's names, and at once attracted the creature. The crocodile came out of the water and touched Lord Chaitanya's feet, at once regaining his original form. Falling before the Lord and offering prayers, the boy retold the story of how he had been cursed. After offering obeisances and praising Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the youth returned to his heavenly abode to bid his parents farewell. As Durvasa had predicted, the boy then returned to Godhead.
So this pastime comes from Prema Vivarta. And so this wasn't really just it wasn't on the program schedule. It was just from a completely other book that I wouldn't have normally looked at or found, but it was extremely relevant, informative. The concept of doing parikrama is very important. You know, just like Muslims, all good Muslims are meant to do Hajj once in their lifetime. At least, some do more often. So, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, as a general principle, they would all go to Vrindavan, and they would all aspire to go to Vrindavan, and at least once in their life do Braj Mandal Parikrama. Same thing with Navadvip Mandal Parikrama. Part of the function of this book is for people who can't go to Vrindavan aren't able to do the full parikrama. They can actually do the parikrama through systematically reading, because ultimately the parikrama is a state of consciousness and is done with one's own devotion rather than just simply physically going, although physically going should not be underestimated. Lord Krishna was the first, when Krishna in Uddhav Sandesh, Krishna tells Uddhava to deliver a message, and he gives a path by which Uddhava should go, how to actually get to Nandagram. And he gives all the different places, and he describes certain pastime places, again, all in just one line. And it's not a full parikrama, but it's from Mathura to Nandagram. And Krishna says, where you do go and where you don't go. He says, avoid the place where I killed Kuvalyapita, you shouldn't go there. That's just not a good place to go. And then he tells him to go to another place where there's lots of swarms of bees. This is a very, very auspicious place to go, a very sweet place. And then he tells different places, one after another. Go to this place. This is where all the gopis, all the girls, weren't gopis anymore, all the girls as I entered the district of Mathura, they were all waiting there to look at me, and they glanced at me. So it was very good. This is where my uncle, Buffalo Farm is. This is where they make wonderful yogurt, and I used to go here and eat yogurt all the time. Coincidentally, it's called Sahara. So you should also go there, and in that area you'll see a place where I used to sit on a rock and play a flute and call the deer, and the deer would come to my flute playing. So that's the original parikrama, and then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went, and so many other devotees, you see here, Janava, Virabhadra, all devotees actually did Rajmandal parikrama. It's one of our devotional activities. It's something that we should do once in our life. I remember Kripa Mahaprabhu, I hope he doesn't mind my quoting him, Kripa Mahaprabhu doing it barefoot, and at the end he said what it was like. He said it was a near-death experience. A lot of things, when you go for that whole 48 days or however many days it goes for, and of course the person who's originally leading that was our Lokanath Maharaj, many things come up, you really come face to face with who you are. A lot of things get stripped away, just like if you do Dandavat Parikrama, Govardhan Dandavat Parikrama, Radhakund Parikrama. Radhakund Parikrama is pretty easy. You can do that in 2 hours. But it's a very good experience, you know, being down in the gutter, having the hogs and dogs, you know, step on you and so on, and what to speak of all the pilgrims who come by. You get a better perspective of who you are when you're down in the dirt, and that's not such a physically daunting thing. Govardhan Parikrama, Dandavat Parikrama that's 9 days for pretty stout people, pretty strong people. Those who aren't so strong, it may take longer. But once again, these are things that, you know, Goswamis, what's the verse? They were always doing it. Sad Goswami Ashtaka, how's it start? Krishna Kirtana Ganana Tanapano. So they were regularly doing this. Raghunath Das Goswami regularly doing it. So it's these are things that should be said part of our itinerary. That Krishna consciousness coming through the temple is not a social function. It's part of our sadhana. We have one older lady in Hungary who lives in New Vrajadam, Lala Krishna, and she's, I don't know, I guess she's my age by now. And she, every Ekadasi, she would do Dandavat Parikrama over the temple. And so, don't make Krishna consciousness something that fits into your comfort zone. It's actually meant to, Krishna is not in there. He's outside the comfort zone. You won't find him there. Should we finish and move on to our other topic? I think time-wise, we're doing good. Yeah, it's important. That's why, for instance, we emphasize, Srila Prabhupada would emphasize selling books. It's like doing Dandavat Parikrama backwards or on your back. And it makes you get out of your comfort zone. And you, it's not the pigs who step on you, it's the people on the street who may be often just like that. But you get a real perspective of what spiritual life is all about and where we need to go in order to get back to Godhead. It's not about, you know, just falling off a cliff or something like that. It's not an easy thing.
Thank you, Maharaj. So we will now go on to another part of this session, and we are going to invite everyone to raise their questions. Now we're going to try to have a very focused discussion on Krishna's pastimes and how we relate to those pastimes as devotees in our stage of Krishna consciousness. And we'll invite you, please put up your hands, but as we mentioned, please keep the questions focused. So Maharaj Srila Prabhupada, of course, gave us the Krishna book, began translating the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam and managed to complete 14 chapters. Someone may say that if we look at the broad, what Srila Prabhupada has given in terms of his writings, he hasn't necessarily seemed to have gone into depth of Krishna's pastimes. If you listen to his lectures, then generally he doesn't have extended narrations of Krishna's pastimes. It seems that Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Krishna consciousness was, perhaps we could say, more had a greater emphasis on tattva and philosophy. And so, why was it that Srila Prabhupada didn't elucidate these pastimes in such a detailed way? Is it because he didn't have time? Is it because he felt the audience maybe was not ready to hear such detail? Or was he presenting something which would be far more practical for our spiritual development? Could you say something about why we don't find this level of detail in Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Krishna's pastimes?
Well, I agree with part of the perception, but there is, Srila Prabhupada did present great detail of Krishna's pastimes in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So you have Antya Lila, most of the Madhya Lila is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's absorption, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going on for pages discussing Krishna's features, his face, his pastimes, so many things. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Charitamrita is really detailed and in some places in a very, in Srila Prabhupada's way and Kaviraj Goswami's way, sort of very innocent way discussing Radha Krishna's Leela, Krishna and the Gopis. So there's a lot there. A lot more than there is in Krishna book. Of course, Srila Prabhupada didn't get to Srimad Bhagavatam, didn't get further on into Bhagavatam's Krishna's pastimes. There is there, which indicates that come the proper book, Srila Prabhupada was not reluctant about presenting what our acharyas presented, and Kaviraj Goswami did. Srila Prabhupada also, I believe in the introduction to Krishna book, lists amongst other things Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's Krishna Bhavanamrita Mahakavya as something the devotee should read, and as well as the other books of the acharyas. So, yes, Prabhupada didn't have time. Prabhupada had to give the foundational texts which we need, the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Nectar of Devotion. Nectar of Devotion, by the way, the latter part of Nectar of Devotion is just Krishna Leela. So the examples that Rupa Goswami gives are all just like these stanzas, you know, Krishna Leela. The description of bhavas, anubhavas, sattvika bhava, and so on, they're all illustrated. So we do get things there, and Srila Prabhupada had no reluctance to present or translate these things. And then Srila Prabhupada wanted us to write. He wanted his followers to write. So when Prabhupada went to one of his godbrothers' ashram, invited there for a program, and as he was leaving, he saw they had their book stall, and he was looking at the book stall. And when he left, Prabhupada commented, he says, they only had books from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He said, where were their books? This is our business. This is our family business for generations to come. His devotees should replace the existent literature that's contaminating people's consciousness and provide those things that actually illuminate and elaborate further on Krishna's Leela, which we see our acharyas have done in unbelievable extent. So Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, and so on. And Prabhupada makes reference to these books and of course encouraged his followers that yes, they must read, they should read the books of the acharyas. It's Prabhupada's quote unquote, yes, they should. So it isn't that we should know about these things, should know, yes, Srila Prabhupada was racing with time as well. But he had a schedule of other things.
Based on that, Maharaj, why then does it seem there's a reticence amongst devotees, a kind of hesitation to study about Krishna's pastimes? Is that something historical, something that went wrong? Is there some basis to that hesitance? Or is it something which we need to overcome?
I guess some devotees do feel like that. There was the historical event of what's called the Gopi Bhava Cup, goes back to the early 70s, which devotees are aware of, which really related to devotees prematurely and getting into a sort of a group happening of reading just exclusively Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. And Srila Prabhupada neither liked the format, neither considered those who were doing that actually qualified to do that type of thing. That didn't make it wrong. So, you know, if you have your 5-year-old child fiddling around with your knife in the kitchen cabinet, you get very upset. If you have a 25-year-old, you know, cooking a meal and taking out knives and so many utensils, then what's the problem? So it's a question of who's qualified to do. Ultimately, we are the Krishna consciousness movement, and we're meant to have that access to transcendental subject matter that will make such an impression within our hearts that this is what we want to be and what we want to do. Are Prabhupada's books enough? Yes. Actually, just chanting Hare Krishna is enough. I don't even need any of the books because the holy name will reveal all those things if we chant it properly. But Srila Prabhupada did give us books to help us chant properly, and he also expected that his followers would also write books. Should they write books just on tattva, just on philosophy? You're going to have a lot of books sitting on the shelf, because devotees are just not going to read only tattva books. A few devotees will, but Krishna's pastimes are automatically attractive. Tattva is also attractive, but it requires a certain type of person who just sort of feeds off that. So there is a fear is there, it's, you know, you tell a child, don't come near the fire. But you can't cook if you don't come near a fire. You can't stay away from a fire forever. So yes, maybe there should be a certain fear, but the fear should be in perspective. I should hear things and do things according to my qualification. Sve sve adhikara ye nishta. And it's a very important principle. It's the principle of education. So you don't take a child and stick him into university. Why not? Well, he may not even know how to count, what to speak of read. So he doesn't have the qualification. The same thing for, in terms of consciousness, the spiritual qualification has to be there for every step that we make. That's why you don't get initiated when you walk in the door. You have to become qualified for first initiation. Then you have to become qualified for second initiation. And then you really have to become qualified for the initiation that you took, because maybe you weren't actually really fully qualified in the mode of goodness, and so on. So, to hear Krishna's pastimes, there's two things. One thing is to hear them and know about them, which is what Srila Prabhupada gave in Krishna book. And another is to actually start systematically studying them. And there's a distinction between the two, and especially systematically studying a certain type of Krishna Leela. So devotees should know about these things. Otherwise, how do we become Krishna conscious? So we become Krishna conscious when we make the proper effort, and a lot of, just like the world that we live in, everyone's looking at their telephone. There's information. There's so much information that they're gleaning that's making an impression in their minds. Our idea is that the devotee should constantly be hearing and remembering about Krishna, so that that impression upon their hearts, first of all, purifies all of these other things, and then really inspires them. They become really Krishna conscious. Day and night, just thinking about Krishna. So when you do that a lot, then it's there. It's constantly there. And then chanting Hare Krishna becomes a lot easier. You wanted to ask something?
Yes, Maharaj. So if someone is reading... Well, first of all, if a new person comes through the door, we give them Bhagavad Gita and we'll give them Krishna book. They can read. At what point, tonight we're talking about Navaraj Mahima, at what point can someone access a book like this? I think many people look at it and they think, that's too much for me, even before they've even opened the pages.
No, it's just that Krishna book is not too much for anybody. Krishna book is the pastime and the philosophy. And it's very, very simple. Probably the most difficult part of Navaraj Mahima is the part describing Gayatri Mantra and the Hare Krishna Mantra. The other things is just in the same vein as Krishna book. There are just more pastime places, familiarizing the reader with Vrindavan Dham and also New Vrindavan at the same time.
Can you elaborate a little more on what is that qualification which allows someone to enter into these pastimes in terms of a deeper study? At what point?
What do you mean by enter?
To study, because you said there's this differentiation between reading and studying. At what point is someone qualified to study?
Well, they can discuss that with their spiritual master. To actually start focusing on something is generally based on a general attraction. The whole idea is seva sara rupena siddha rupena chatrihi tadbhava lipshuna karya. So raja loka anushartaha. So in many places Rupa Goswami says raja loka anushartaha, that we should follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan. How do we follow? We hear about them. And why do we hear about, I don't know, cowherd boys? Why do we hear about Mother Yashoda? Because we have a particular attraction for that. You have a folio on there? If you just go to 10th Canto, Chapter 9, Verse 3, Prabhupada's purport. And you can see what anyone who's got it, just let me know.
Should I read the purport?
You got it?
Yes.
Okay, this is Sukadev Goswami is describing, this is the beginning of Damodar Lila. He says, dressed in a saffron yellow sari with a belt tied about her full hips, Mother Yashoda pulled on the churning rope, laboring considerably, her bangles and earrings moving and vibrating, and her whole body shaking. Because of her intensive love for her child, her breasts were wet with milk. Her face, with its very beautiful eyebrows, was wet with perspiration, and Malati flowers were falling from her hair. You have to picture Srila Prabhupada is laying down. Or if he's not laying down, he's very sick. He's in Vrindavan. This is sometime in the summer of 1977 or in the fall. And he writes the following. Anyone who desires to be Krishna conscious in motherly affection or parental affection should contemplate the bodily features of Mother Yashoda. It is not, and now Prabhupada always puts in a warning. It is not that one should desire to become like Yashoda, for this is Mayavad. In other words, you can't become Mother Yashoda. Either in parental affection or conjugal love, friendship or servitorship, in any way, we must follow in the footsteps of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, not try to become like them, meaning them. Therefore, this description is provided here. Then Prabhupada continues, and this is what you're asking about. Advanced devotees must cherish this description, always thinking of Mother Yashoda's features, how she was dressed, how she was working and perspiring, how beautifully the flowers were arranged in her hair, and so on. One should take advantage of the full description provided here by thinking of Mother Yashoda in maternal affection for Krishna. So when a devotee's become advanced, that he has some level of attraction. And is that level of attraction sufficient, pure, to qualify him? He has to, either his guru or his gurus have to confirm it. Then he can start doing what Srila Prabhupada points out here, that one should meditate, one should take advantage, always think about this. Then I want to look up all descriptions about Mother Yashoda, and I'm going to collect so many things. Mother Yashoda's just like Mother Yashoda's described as Rupa Goswami says, she's neither thin nor chubby, so she's she has very long black hair. She likes wearing saris that are
like the rainbow, colorful, like the rainbow. So it's nice. There's a nice description. Here, it's just different. It's sort of a yellow color or saffron color. So that then becomes a whole different thing. Now I'm going to actually study, and I'm going to systematically read, and because I'm interested, I want to serve in that way. Is it good for me to do that? Then you need guidance. That's what gurus are meant for. They're not meant to give me blessings to get good marks in school.
We just open up to the floor. I don't know if anyone would like to ask any questions on this topic and how it relates. Yes, we have a question here.
Yes,
thank you.
A fabulous lecture with many questions. One thing we didn't touch on a little bit was what does program do for you? And rather than just a question, it's just a comment that you might like to answer afterwards.
Shortly. Short, Esther.
During Kirti, Aswami, our beloved Srimati Radhika, she blesses us with everything, that every prayer, every extra bit of service will be hundreds of times manifold. And I remember when Srila Prabhupada was opening Krishna and Balaram, I was there. And there was one thing he said to Surabhi Maharaj. When we were sitting there, and he said to Surabhi Maharaj, you should do parikram with an intensity of prayer where the pastimes will manifest in your heart. So during Kartik, when we go to those pastime places, and we bow down, like Maharaj said, with that intensity, that sincerity, that faith. And we beg for those pastimes to manifest in our hearts. The Dharma can give it us. Giri Govardhan can give us praying. Vrindadevi, the original Vrindadevi is saying, come here, will give it to us. And not only that, there's our sincerity, intensity, our spiritual master can give it us. So the whole process of Krishna consciousness is to manifest what our lives are going to be like in the future. We're all going to be in Vrindavan. That's where you will be, where my dear Shivaram will be. That is where our Srila Prabhupada is. So of course we all want to go there. So parikram is very important. And for Maharaj to come here and explain so beautifully about hungry, that how he's manifested Vrindavan there. Also, Radhanath Swami manifested it in Bombay, in the village there. Unbelievable. And Maharaj has also explained to us that within our own hearts, we can create Vrindavan and a parikram. So I'd just like to thank you all.
Thank you.
Bless you.
Maharaj, would you like to comment anything on parikrama, anything further?
Everything she said is wonderful. That wonderful quote I didn't know to Sir Abhi. That was wonderful. The Prabhupada said that. Yeah, part of that whole. I mean, there's a whole science to parikrama. When you start off, you're supposed to do puja, worship, get Hanuman's blessings of everyone. And you start off in a certain place, and it's a meditation, it's absorption of the leelas that take place. It's as much as we make of it.
As we wait for the next question, Maharaj, just to try to understand this more clearly, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as we know, came to give not only very freely, but to give something very, very special. Chaitanya Charitamrita mentions, Raga Marga Bhakti Loke Karite Pracharan, that Mahaprabhu came to give Raganuga Bhakti. So can you just more clearly just elucidate for us? We are in the process of Vedi Sadhana Bhakti. What does it mean to practice Raganuga Bhakti within ISKCON, within our movement? What does that look like, and what is the process for that? If you could say
briefly. Briefly. Yes, spontaneous devotional service is the only means to go to Vrindavan. We don't go to Vrindavan by regulated devotional service. So unless you awaken a natural, spontaneous rag, attraction for Krishna, and specifically Rajaloka, and you follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan, and develop an attraction for that, you can't go to Vrindavan. The principle is that wherever you have a particular inclination to or attachment to, you will develop that type of love, and that type of love will allow you to go to Vaikuntha or Dwarka or Ayodhya. But to Braj, to go to Braj, one has to awaken. And this is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu offered. It was something that really wasn't known aside from Madhavendra Puri. There was no one who was really relishing the mellows of spontaneous devotional service, or spontaneous love. And Lord Chaitanya is giving that, allowing everyone to do that and making that known, something that even was not widely known even by advanced devotees. And that's one reason why we need to read Srila Prabhupada's books, especially Chaitanya Charitamrita, as you are quoting, because we practice regulated devotional service to purify our hearts and to come to the stage where we actually start to awaken an attraction for Krishna and enter into sort of the realm of spontaneous practice, where spontaneous practice means that, where you start to actually meditate and focus on the devotee or the type of devotional service of your choice, whether it's Sakya Ras or Madhurya Ras or Vatsalya Ras, and a specific devotee, and your spiritual body manifests accordingly, provided that you have the proper association and guidance for that. But it's not artificial. And that was Srila Prabhupada's both real warnings and sternness. You can't jump there. You have to purify her because there's a real danger. And that danger is called sahajaism. That sahaja means you don't have the qualification. But just because there's a warning for people who don't have qualification doesn't mean that the thing is bad. And it's not that the thing is bad. This is ISKCON's mission. This is what Lord Chaitanya came for. This is what we're here for. But it requires the proper purification of heart, and that purification of heart comes by regulated devotional service for the most part, unless someone's carrying this over from a past life. And when the heart becomes sufficiently pure, then under proper guidance, we'll see if some real, genuine attraction and attachment awakens. But this is our process. So similarly, Vaidhi Marg, Krishna explains, those who just stick to the process of Vaidhi Marg, they cannot go to Vrindavan, they go to Vaikuntha. But our movement is all about this, and the real followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will naturally, at some stage in their Krishna consciousness, and because it's spontaneous, you can't stay where it starts to manifest. It isn't just going from one stage to another. It will be a development of attraction at the stages, especially of ruchi, asakti. These are still stages of sadhana bhakti, but here already spontaneity is manifesting more and more. One in the taste of devotional activities, and the other was in attraction to Krishna himself. But certainly when one crosses the bounds of conditioning and one comes to the transcendental platform, when one comes to the platform of bhava bhakti, at that stage, all those who are real followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu enter into the stage of devotional practice, spontaneous practice. It's not really practice as we practice now, but at the same time, it's also not sadhya. It's not perfection. It still becomes an interim stage, where even when one is awakened, ecstatic devotional service, he still needs guidance in order to awaken all the different aspects of his spiritual identity, the bhavas, his name, his form, etc., and to cultivate what he has, which is not full-blown love, but it's actually the real spark. So of devotional service is really manifest. That's what Krishna consciousness is about. So being afraid of that, being backing off of that, is putting obstacles on our own path of spiritual life. We need to see things in the proper perspective and do things in the proper way.
I think, Marge, when devotees approach this topic, I think this Sahajya topic is something which really makes people back off, and I guess we don't hear about it so much. We don't talk about it in our circles. Is that something that should be changed?
We hear a lot more from Prabhupada about Mayavadis. That doesn't stop us from practicing Krishna consciousness, just because Prabhupada just here said, you don't try and be Mother Yashoda, that's Mayavad. So, alright, I'm backing off because it's Mayavad. So, just because you're given the warnings, you know, you drive along the road and it says, you know, watch out for the lorry turning in the left, and there's so many watch out signs. Doesn't mean I'm not going outside in the car. There's so many other obstacles coming in the way that possibly may happen. But no, we just go down the road, be careful how you drive, and you get to your destination. But there are pitfalls. And part of that is to know what the pitfalls are. You go into chemistry laboratory, and, you know, the professor will tell you, well, don't do this or don't do that. This is going to blow up in your face if you mix the wrong chemicals together. So that doesn't mean that, well, I'm not going in here at all. You just do the right thing. And Prabhupada gives us what the right thing is. You follow the right thing, you get the right result.
At one point, Marge, you say in the book, in Navaraj Mahima, that one thing that we observe is that devotees, when they're approaching Krishna's Leela, then many times they ask questions, well, how does this happen? How does that take place? That's beyond our conception. And why does it happen? Why does it happen like that? But you say at one point in the book that a devotee comes to a certain stage of maturity when they read these pastimes, they hear these pastimes, and they just feel this experience of wonder. Just how wonderful Krishna is. Rather than analyzing it and trying to understand the logic behind it and so on, just this experience that, my wonderful Krishna. And maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit. At what stage does that happen? And is that something that comes naturally, or is it something that we need to...
It's good to be inquisitive and to ask and to clarify. That's our process. And we want to purify our hearts. It's like chanting Hare Krishna. We struggle. How do I stay awake? How do I keep my mind from wandering, etc., etc.? But when we actually purify our hearts, then at a certain point, you just sit there and chant and chant and chant and chant, and you don't want to stop, because that's the proper type of chanting. It comes with a certain spiritual maturity. So yes, devotees should ask questions, they should get answers to all their questions, they should practice Krishna consciousness nicely, and as they become purified, they're no longer so much interested in all the they have no longer any doubts, they have no questions, they just also want to be part of the lila. And you enter into that lila by hearing it, by just allowing yourself to be absorbed as a hearer, not in any kind of participant, but I really want to hear, and there's nothing that obstructing my hearing process. So that means that you get a real relish. It's just like when you don't get in the way of chanting Hare Krishna, then the holy name manifests its potency. So tavakatamritam tapta jivanam. So this is life. It started earlier on, introducing our talk, this is another reality. There is no other reality. This is reality. This is the only reality. And everything else is illusion. This is all illusion. This is the reality. And what is spontaneous devotional service? Well, just look how we are absorbed in the material world. It's very spontaneous. It's very natural. That's how we're meant to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And another example is all parents know children. 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-olds, when they play, I'm Hanuman, I'm Ramachandra, I'm this. They're absorbed. That's spontaneous devotional service. They really identify with persons. So in the same way that we're naturally connected with this world, and you know, sense gratification, material life comes so naturally, that same way actually is how we're meant to be absorbed in Krishna and things related to Krishna. And that's spontaneous devotional service. But it means switching from this faith and contamination to the material world, which requires vaidhi, siddhanta, philosophy, real purification of the heart. And when we realize that we have no fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, children, friends, etc., but there are only spirit souls and there are devotees, and that this material world is all Krishna's potency and Krishna's energy, then it starts to become very natural life. It's like waking, Prabhupada says, waking up from a dream. So when you're dreaming, it's spontaneous, you're absorbed in that dream, but when you come up, then you wake up and again you come into this reality. So this is the reality. And we need to wake up to that reality, but that requires love. It requires attraction. That becomes the key feature. You can't make it happen. It's spontaneous, it's natural. If something's natural, you can't make it happen. You know, you can't go over to a fruit tree and start beating it because you want the fruit in April when it only gives the fruit in July. So nothing's going to happen. So it's spontaneous. And it will happen if we do the right thing. What did Srila Prabhupada say? And what did Prabhupada do? So study it. And if you study it, then this is, Prabhupada wants us to be lovers of Krishna. Mad after Krishna, Prabhupada.
And I guess that's really the function of Navaraj Mahima, is really to allow us to absorb in Krishna and to learn more about his name, form, qualities, pastimes, abode, his associates, and to really grab that kind of attraction. You said we can't do something, but I guess sort of absorbing ourselves in the practice and hearing about Krishna, at some point it rubs off.
Yes, it rubs off. This is why all acharyas wrote books. We got tons and tons of wonderful literature that Srila Prabhupada did want us to read, that did access. We have people have a natural inclination to hear more, to know more. Krishna is unlimited. So therefore all of these things are really unlimited. Two qualities I can just point out without appearing self-serving is, number one, unfortunately the quality of many of the books, with the exception of BBT books, that are translations of Acharya's works are not representative of the content. And very often neither is the, I can't say the translation because I don't know Sanskrit, but neither is the English. The English is often very, it takes a lot of work. I probably read a page over that I write at least 6 times, if not 10. And then an editor does the same thing. Navaraj Maharaj had 2 editors. And then a proofreader goes over it again, and then it gets laid out, and then it gets printed. So we need to represent the quality of the subject matter has to be in a presentable way. And so often devotees complain that, these books are expensive. We're sort of spoiled by the sort of volume that the BBT books are distributed at, allows them to actually sell at a relatively low price, especially in the English language. So we've printed, I don't know how many millions of Bhagavad Gitas. Then it becomes easy when you're only printing 300, then, they just press the button and then press the stop button, and the books being printed, it just goes so fast, it's nothing. The quality of these things, the real gold standard is Brihad Bhagavatamrita, BBT's Brihad Bhagavatamrita, in terms of English, in terms of clarity of presentation, in terms of the scholarly translation and explanation. That's how these books should be, and they're the most important things. They should really, everything else should reflect the content, the books themselves.
Just have a few more minutes if anyone would like to ask any final questions on this subject. And we can take one question. Yeah, Tarun Krishna.
Thank you, Guru Maharaj and Prabhu, for a wonderful presentation. I'd just like to ask Guru Maharaj that Srila Prabhupada said that wherever you read his books, it's like biting into a sweet ball. It's sweet everywhere. It's always tasty. Srila Kirti Prabhu relays that. But I've also heard that you were answering a question recently to one devotee, and you were saying that when devotees become more mature, they'll be more attracted to Krishna's direct pastimes, like in the 10th canto Srimad Bhagavatam. So how is it that Srila Prabhupada says it's all absolute, it's all has the same taste, but at the same time then, also you'd said that when devotees chant names of Krishna that are more direct, that are relating to his Vrindavan pastimes, they get more purification. So how do we correlate those two things?
My earlier statement that it's very important to know what did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu come for? What did he teach? Especially what did our acharyas from him? What did Srila Prabhupada say? Srila Prabhupada was with us for 12 years. He said a lot of things. You got to put it all together. You can't just take one thing. So you have to put the whole message all together. It's just like, you go in the classroom and the teacher said this and you walk out and you think, now I know everything. I mean, it's a 4-year course. You can't just go on the basis of what the teacher said today. You have to go the whole length. And part of the challenge of going back to Godhead is you've got to put the puzzle together. You've got to take the pieces, and it's just like a jigsaw puzzle, right? When you have the picture, you cut it up. So you take pieces, and you have to put all the pieces together. That means studying what did Srila Prabhupada say, so that ultimately, because we have to have the conviction and the faith based on our own research. So Srila Prabhupada said, well, just chant 16 rounds and follow regulated principles. But he also said, if you don't read the books, what's the use? So Srila Prabhupada really, really struggled for that. And this is our culture. Our culture is not just writing books, it's reading books. And that's what we should really sort of dedicate our time and stay away from other things that take our time and contaminate our consciousness. And that's, of course, a whole other issue and other direction to avoid is what we do and then what we don't do. Because, I don't know, social media, YouTube, videos, television, movies, etc. These things are just the antithesis of what hearing about Krishna is all about. This is hearing about what Maya is all about. So good quality association, and ultimately when you take those things, Prabhupada said this, but Prabhupada also said that, and Prabhupada said, see what picture it actually really makes. And devotees need to be convinced. What did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu just read? Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that's how we study Srila Prabhupada's books, and then we get a very clear picture that yes, this is what Srila Prabhupada wants. But in a worldwide movement, at the same time when you're trying to bring people from, you know, the animal form of life and try and coax them to become human beings, then you don't just start talking about Raganuga Bhakti. That may be the goal, but we're doing so many things simultaneously, and that's why it has to be a systematic process. And we see that devotees, you know, have a difficulty in getting up early. You can't get up early in the morning, you know, and go local Vrindavan, they don't sleep. And they're tired. And they got red eyes, including Krishna, from not sleeping enough. So you better get ready and don't try and be well rested. So there are so many just basic preliminary things to even qualify us to be quote-unquote practicing devotees, sadhakas, regulated devotees, who then all of that does place a very guarded issue. It becomes, you know, things are parokshavad. Things are indirectly presented because we're preaching to the world. And we're preaching the highest to the lowest. And somehow or another, we've got to bring everybody step by step forward. And that requires expertise, and that was Srila Prabhupada's expertise. That everything's there for the kindergarten to the PhD.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. It's been a beautiful evening. I think through these discussions, you've made such a beautiful subject matter that's also a subject matter which is often maybe not understood in its totality. You've presented it beautifully in such a chaste way and also made it something accessible and inspiring for all of us. To not just become Krishna conscious, but to become Vrindavan conscious. And we would like to invite all the devotees that we have these newly printed special edition sets of Navavraja Mahima on the table here. A beautiful 9-volume set. You saw some excerpts on the slides, beautiful pictures and maps. And we invite everyone to come and take a look and take a set with you. and in this way become absorbed in the pastimes of Krishna, and not the other reality, but the only reality, which is the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan. So thank you so much, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna, thank you all very much. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Varagokulananda ki jai.